about that apology. Otherwise, welcome everybody. Feel free to participate in this meeting and shape the bills that we need to do. Otherwise, officials from the department, officials from the portfolio committee, members of the media, if they are here with us, a very good morning and a warm welcome to the meeting. I have, as I've said, three apologies. I've already dealt with the apology from the minister. The other honorable member who has written an apology is the Honorable Noluchungu. He is attending to the doctor. And we have also an apology from the deputy minister. The apology is saying the minister, deputy minister, had arranged, had a prior arrangement with a back to school event in Pietermaritzburg. And that apology was sent by Lesego Itumeleng. Those are the three apologies that has formally, through the correct channels, reached my table. Am I correct, Valerie?
Chair, you are correct. And there was also apology from Mr. Sabisi this morning from the NFP, who's attending the committee that he's a full-time member on.
Is the apology properly written, Valerie?
Definitely, Chair, and was sent by Happiness on behalf of Mr. Sabisi.
Okay, I did miss that one. Is Lesego in the meeting?
I'm not sure, Chair. Maybe the department
can... No, Chair. No, she's with the Deputy Minister.
Okay, I was just... I had a bit of a concern, but I'll raise maybe with the office of the deputy minister. Back to school event. Let me leave it at that. Honorable Minister, we are on item number one, where the department is going to brief us on the National Land Transport Amendment Bill on matters pertaining to the President's reservations on the bill. Can we allow you, Honorable Minister, to lead us on this one? And I'm sure thereafter you'll give to your officials to further present to us, as you will be leaving. Let me allow you that space. Thank you very much and a very good morning. I can see you're bright and energetic this morning. Welcome, Honorable Minister.
Chairperson Mangete and members of the Portfolio Committee, Deputy Minister of Transport, Ms. Sindisiwe Chikunga, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. In 2020, the National Assembly passed the National Land Transport Amendment Bill to give effect to a number of provisions that aimed at strengthening the regulatory framework and broaden the powers of the national and provincial spheres of government in relation to subsidized bus contracts. The President sent the bill back to Parliament in September 2021, flagging a number of reservations with specific clauses that confer power on the national and provincial spheres of government to conclude subsidized bus contracts. We are under no illusion that our task is point to these specific clauses that were flagged by the President and does not include other provisions contained in the bill. the amendments to the National Land Transport Act that are subject of today's discussion were necessitated by the difficulties experienced over the years of building requisite capacity at local government level. This capacity is necessary to enable the transfer of public transport services to the most appropriate sphere of government. Our policy framework takes due regard of the provisions of the Constitution, which requires that municipal public transport be managed at that level. We have put in place a legal framework that guides public transport planning at municipal level, which planning enables decision making and allocation of resources. It is precisely this planning that will then enable municipalities to rationalize public transport services and ensure an effective rollout of integrated public transport networks. This will equally enable a redesign of services that will allow us to make a clean break from apartheid spatial planning and shorten commuting time. The legislative amendments were meant to empower the provincial and national spheres of government to step in and ensure continued provision of subsidized public transport services where relevant municipalities are yet to develop capacity to manage this on their own. This is a crucial intervention that will enable us to move faster in redesigning services in a manner that ensures modal integration and the introduction of a subsidy scheme that is informed by travel demand. We do believe that the necessary interventions to build the requisite capacity can be affected through the current legislative framework. This includes issuing a ministerial direction in the event either a province or municipality fails in fulfilling an executive obligation as provided for in Section 5-6 of the Municipal of the Principal Act. The monitoring measures provided for in the Annual Division of Revenue Act is an additional instrument that enables strict monitoring of the use of conditional grants. In conclusion, having taken due regard of the interventions provided for in Section 100 and 139 of the Constitution, we believe that the most appropriate policy position will be one that favors strengthening the capacity of provinces to intervene and ensure continuity in the provisions of public transport services at municipal level. This can be achieved through a number of measures, some of which are already provided for in the existing enactment of the NLTA. I thank you, Mangete. I will then call the acting DG and the DDGs to take you through the presentation. Thank you.
Asibonge Jola. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. I know we are going to lose you due to other commitments. Hope you have a better day. Thank you very much for that. Acting DG.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the esteemed members of Parliament and the committee, portfolio committee. Chair, we will start by presenting to you the National Land Transport Act, number 5 of 2009, as the principal act. And I will call upon Acting Deputy Director General, Ms. Manana, to take you through the presentation, Chair. And over to you, DDG.
Thank you. DG, good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Minister. Good morning, members of the Portfolio Committee and colleagues in the transport sector from the Department and Ministry. As the acting DG has said, I'm Kili Manana and I am acting. I'll take you through the presentation for today. Can I be given the powers to share the presentation?
I am borrowing you. I can't give you, Kili. I will borrow you the powers to share. Valerie, let's borrow Kili powers to share.
So that has been done a while ago, Ms. Manana.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Okay. Can you put it on? Chair, can you see the presentation?
I don't see the presentation. I see the roads and the... that is the presentation. Yes, I'm seeing it.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so... So as we indicated, we're providing a briefing to the Portfolio Committee to respond to concerns that were raised by the President or other reservations on some provisions in the bill. So the presentation will cover, just give a brief background and then also present the President's reservation and our response to each of those, and then we then end with the conclusion. Just to remind the committee members, honourable members, that the Act originally was enacted to continue a process that was started by the National Land Transport Transition Act of 2000, and that Act initiated the process to transform and restructure the land transport system in South Africa. And so the bill was developed to update the Act. There have been changes since 2009. And also, I think most of the members would be aware of the e-hailing services we needed to provide for the regulation of those services, and then also provide for the amendment of contracting arrangements, among other issues. So the objective of the Principal Act was to consolidate all functions to the local sphere to deal with fragmentation of functions. And according to the Principal Act, only municipalities have got the power to enter into new public transport contracts. And however, there have been challenges since 2009 because not even a single municipality has actually been able to take over some of the old contracts are from provinces, even though some of the municipalities, especially the ones implementing integrated public transport networks, are performing the contracting function. What we're finding with other municipalities, they don't have that capacity to perform that function. So the Act, therefore, was allowing provinces, the original Act allowed provinces as well as national to continue being a contracting authority for old order bus contracts. Now, in trying to deal with this matter of capacity, the bill basically sought to amend Section 11 of the original Act that then allowed only municipalities to enter into contracts. It now proposed that provinces could conclude new contracts, and that also national government could also intervene where provinces and municipalities fail to perform this duty. Now, the President expressed reservations about clauses 7A, 7B, 7H, 7I, 7J, 7K, 7L, and 7M. And it was based on objections raised by SAUGA and the City of Cape Town. And so I will basically briefly go into the reservations that the President raised. The first reservation is on clause 7A. It deals with the contracting function, granting the contracting function to national sphere of government. And the president basically raised a concern saying that this is a function of local government. And I think I indicated earlier on that public transport is a concurrent function across the national sphere, provincial sphere, as well as local sphere. But certain functions, for example, municipal public transport is only for, or is only to be performed by a municipality. So now this concern is it's really linked to that, that national sphere cannot assume local government functions for itself. And that also the difficulty with that clause, it was just conferring powers to national on a whole lot of, a wide range of contracts, irrespective of whether they were national, provincial, or local in scope. And our response as a department, we indicate that Schedule 4, Parts A and B of the Constitution, as I indicated earlier on, allocates public transport to all three spheres. And therefore, we suggest that, and we do recognize that municipal public transport is only for the benefit, or rather to be performed by a municipal sphere. And therefore, we can agree to delete that national sphere has powers to perform that function on behalf of the municipality. And therefore, we propose that we delete that clause. And then we also then say that the minister can use a Section 5-6 of the Nation of the Principal Act that basically provides for him to intervene on matters of public transport, and also that the Constitution also allows us to, or allows the minister rather, to intervene through Section 11 and in provinces, and also Section 139 in municipalities. The second clause of the reservation raised is 7B, and this one deals with the granting of powers to the provincial sphere. And we indicate, Chair and honourable members, that the President also raised a similar reservation to that clause, and that it effectively was also saying that municipalities could only perform that function if they met certain requirements and criteria to be prescribed by the minister, and therefore that the province must then step in and conclude new contracts on behalf of the minister, of the municipality. And therefore, this also becomes a constitutionality issue in the sense that municipal public transport can only be performed by a municipality. And our response, Chair and honourable members, is that the department is of the view that that the function to provinces as currently provided in Clause 7B of the amendment bill can then be also taken away, that we will not allow provinces to then perform that function on behalf of municipalities, and that municipalities will have the exclusive right to conclude those new contracts as originally proposed by the Principal Act, and that, however, provinces can still perform this function on behalf of the municipality if they don't have capacity or whatever circumstances they may present, and we will use then Section 12 of the Principal Act to then allow the municipality and the province to enter into an agreement where the province can then perform that function on behalf of the municipality. And basically, Section 12 provides for that. Clause 7H, basically was indicating that municipalities can only perform that function, a contracting function, if they meet certain requirements and criteria to be prescribed by the minister. It was basically then amending Section 11.6 and the new Section 11.9. And the concern expressed by the President was that the constitutionality of this provision, basically along the same grounds that national and provincial government cannot assume a municipal functions, and that also the other second concern about the new section 11.6 was that it basically was allowing provinces to act as contracting authority for contracts concluded under the National Transition Act until those contracts lapse or expire or are cancelled or replaced. And basically now there were words inserted that unless that function has been assigned to a municipality. So basically it was then saying, it was allowing them to continue to then be contracting authority for those old contracts. Even when an instance where the municipality was then ready to take on those that contract rather, then they were not going to be enabled to do that, taking that power away from the municipality so that it can then perform or it can be assigned that contract and that function. And then thirdly, there was a concern that there was no flexibility in the provision in that it will only apply even if the contract is exclusively for public transport within a specific municipality. And even if the municipality had capacity, which is what I had just said, that it then limited that flexibility. When the municipality has got capacity to perform it, then they wouldn't be able to do that because then the province would have the powers to continue to be the contracting authority on those old water contracts. The department agrees that the proposed proviso or provision in Clause 7H, which then provided for prescribed requirements and criteria by the minister, be deleted, and that we agree that the municipality will have exclusive right to then conclude a new contract. Then Clause 7I. Okay. Clause 7I was basically looking at exemption from the proviso to Section 11C, and basically it was proposing that municipalities must apply or may apply to the minister for exemption from the need to comply with the prescribed requirements and criteria that the minister would have set before they can contract. And therefore, this has been raised as it has been objected on the basis of constitutional grounds. And the department's response is that we agree that this clause should be deleted as a consequential amendment, as a proviso to Section 11.1C, Roman Figure 21, will be deleted. And then Clause 7J was also, it had to do with assignment of the contracting function, and also that Clause 7J will make a consequential amendment to Section 11.12 of the Act, where the removal of the assignment of the contracting function was then going to be effected in the sense that the municipality wouldn't be able to be assigned that contracting function. And it's also been expressed, or the reservation expressed is that it's also objected to on the basis of the constitutionality of that provision. 7J, okay, the department's response. Chair and honourable members, we are agreeing that we delete that Clause 7J as well, and that the assignment of the function should be retained in the original Act, and that then the municipality would then be able to be assigned that function, and also then remove the need for them to apply to meet certain prescribed requirements and criteria, as was proposed in the amendment bill. And then the rest of the clauses, Chairperson and honourable members, are also then consequential amendments in relation to the removal of the assignment of the contracting function. And therefore, Clause 7K, it's a similar issue, and it's been questioned on the basis of constitutionality, and the department agrees that we then remove that Clause 7K. And then the next one is 7L. And also we are agreeing that we also delete 7L. And then there's also 7M. Yes. And then 7M as well, it was providing that provinces can act as a contracting authority for contracts concluded under the Transition Act. And the concern expressed was that that they should, yes, basically that the amendment bill was giving provinces the power to continue to act. And that the reservation was that it then there was no flexibility in that it basically then allowed the province to continue being the contracting authority, even on a function or on a contract that could easily be then performed by the municipality, because it then had the capacity to administer that contract. So we also are agreeing that we remove 7M, that clause, and that it should be deleted to leave Section 11(6) of the Principal Act as it is. In conclusion, Chairperson and the Honourable Members, the Department is of the view that we basically agree with the reservations that have been raised by the President, and that we will remove all those clauses or provisions in the amendment bill, as indicated earlier on, and that we propose that going forward, that Section 11A, 11(1)A, 6 of the Principal Act provides that the national sphere of government is responsible for capacitating and monitoring provinces, and also that provinces must also do the same thing, capacitate and monitor municipalities, so that the lack of capacity or resources to perform the land transport function is then addressed. So we're saying this section, there is a section that then mandates us to build that capacity, and both national and provincial should then perform, make sure that we perform in relation to those clauses. Further, Section 11A(b)(6) also provides that, okay, I've already said that the provincial sphere must then build the capacity in municipalities, and that we further say, given the capacity challenge in the different municipalities, that together with provinces, we must make sure that those provisions in the Principal Act are then ensured to create that capacity that is required for municipalities to then become contracting authorities, and that they then perform the function as originally proposed by the Principal Act. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. This is the end of our presentation. Thank you for your attention.
Kibi?
Yes, Chair.
Can you bring back our power of sharing? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. that is the end of the presentation. Just to remind members that we were told about the situation, that the President has expressed some reservations at some point. And we had a very small discussion. I remember one Honorable Member saying, I told you that some of the clause here would actually land us in the situation where we are. I'm saying that because I want to remember that there was some willingness in this committee to look into the President's reservations, and now we are also going to be looking into basically what the department is saying, which I see as basically agreeing with the President and say initiating a process where we should delete some of the clause and amend some of the clause. So there are two options here, and I'm going to say Valerie should explain those options so that we are clear on the processes, as I allow members to participate, so that we don't waste a lot of time really struggling in terms of which process are we following. Ms. Karelse, are you with us?
Chair, I am with you. As I've indicated to you this morning, remitted bills are dealt with in terms of Joint Rule 203. And it states that the committee must confine itself to the president's reservations, and that was reiterated by Parliament's legal advisor on a question in the previous meeting on what portion should be dealt with, if the committee could deal with other portions, but the rules are clear, Chair. It says must confine itself to the president's reservations. Further, Chair, I've indicated to you as well, this bill is it was tagged as a Section 76 bill. And in terms of the rule, the committee must also confer with the corresponding council committee. It doesn't say how it should confer, but I would think, Chair, that a joint meeting on this bill, as the committee processes it, will suffice. And further, Chair, the rule says the committee must report to the National Assembly on the President's reservations. If the committee agrees with the President's reservations, the committee must present with its report an amended bill to correct those defects as it was raised in the reservations, Chair. So the committee will then go through a process where there would be a new list of amendments and a new bill. So the bill numbers would obviously change. There would be the A list would become the E list. The bill would become an F bill because already the NCLP had a C and a D version of the bill. So the committee will then go through this process as normally how it would amend bills and finalize the final version. That is when the committee agrees to share with the president's reservations. If the committee does not agree with the president's reservations, the committee will report as such. And if the report is adopted by the House, the remitted bill in its current form would be returned to the president with a message that the National Assembly does not agree with the reservations of the president. So that is the process, Chair. But for now, the most important part is that it must confine itself with the reservations, and it's important that there must be at some stage a meeting with the NCOP so that the committee can finalize whatever its decision it's making on this bill. That's all from me, Chair, for now.
For now, that's all from Ms. Carol Seh. Thank you very much, Ms. Carol Seh. I now open this floor to the honorable members of the committee. No copying, please, today. Let me see hands and close. After noting those hands, I'll then close the hand session. We have Honorable Unsinga, followed by Ubaba Umangu, followed by Ubaba Uketa Amabala Wagastole. Mondize Keta. Any other hand? Nobody should say I did not see them, because I will close my list of Baba Makosini will come. Thank you. You have raised your hand today because if members want to speak, they say they speak like you without raising their hands. Honorable Umhlekazi Ubaba uChris Hunsengr. Good morning. Akbareliede, you can come in.
Schönen guten Morgen, Herr Vorsitzender Beamte. Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. Good morning, colleagues. Thank you for the department for the submission. I also want to acknowledge the presence of Minister Mbalula. Chairperson, the NLTA offered an opportunity for change. I do recognize that the change which we are considering is confined to the reservations expressed by the President's office, but I must take this opportunity to just put on record that this was the second time where this bill was passed in a very hasteful manner. The NLTA bill is the ideal opportunity Chairperson, to address so many and still currently outstanding matters and issues in the relationship management of public transport stakeholders and the environment. And for the second time, this was missed. Therefore, this bill was passed in a very hasteful manner. Warnings, indeed, as you confirmed, Chairperson, were raised that there are constitutional issues which might stand in conflict, which is now being pointed out. So, Chairperson, all I want to submit is that still there are outstanding matters in terms of public transport, relationship management, which need to be addressed, which we constantly, on a continuous basis, have matters and issues with in operations and in conflicting circumstances. Therefore, Chairperson, I beg you to please, let's consider to, after completing this process, to again get the NLPA back on the table so that we can address those matters. The reservations and conflicts that were mentioned, I absolutely support the process going forward. I think it is important that the F version would be printed and that that would give us a particular insight of how the bill would read in its form as suggested by the department now. The F bill will certainly assist in that because it's difficult now to relate to the context and alignment to other portions of the bill. In particular, the fact that Section 12 has also been amended to allow for provincial transport authority in the formation thereof. And I do have concerns about the appropriateness of this, which the department is now relying on, and the Section 7 sub B concern. So we will have to look at that again, but the F version will certainly help us to then look at that again. So Chairperson, I do support the notion that we have a joint meeting with the Select Committee in the NCOP since it was a Section 76 bill. So I do support that notion so that we can at least process what is currently at table. But again, I ask you to please consider that the NLTA needs to be returned to the table of the Portfolio Committee for further improvements in the relationship of public transport stakeholder relationship. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Member Mhlekazi. Jambas.
Morning, Honorable Mangete. Honorable Mangete. Morning, colleagues. To the Minister and the Department. Chair, I think my colleague, although that was not the reason I raised my hand, who has just spoken, Honorable Hunsinger, raised a couple of issues. Which are difficult not to comment on and solicit some more information, which, if you allow me, I will start with and then make my comments. Firstly, I would have asked also the nature of the joint meeting with the NCOP and the time frames that we have. That would have been my question after the input by Ms. Carlse, to say what limitations do we have, who initiates that meeting, so that I think we agree that we need to do that as quickly as possible. My second comment, again, emanating from my colleague's input, is that F version, which Ms. Carlse had mentioned. Once more, my input there is the time frames. When can we expect it? Because it then gives us, as my colleague has said, a full picture of all these amendments or corrections, whatever we want to call them, and their implication thereof. Lastly, on my colleague's comments, he says the committee should make sure that the NLTA comes back for other issues that is raising. Mine again, there is an issue of process. Who initiates that process? So that again, we can put time frames to it if the committee agrees. But for me, if the committee agrees, which I don't think we should have a problem doing it, we should rather put time frames so that we don't have these things open-ended. Maybe there is nothing to be dealt with, but my colleague feels there are issues to be dealt with, so let's confront it and deal with it once and for all. Now, going back to the presentation, Chair, I'm seeking only one clarity. One, the presenter, I just couldn't get the slide number, said before, I think she was speaking about the 7B concerns. The slide before that, she was speaking about the reliance on Section 5-6 that could be relied on or could be used in terms of what was being proposed or being raised as concerns by the president. In the same vein as Section 12, which my colleague has spoken to, I would like to hear what does that Section 5-6 say that it seems the department is falling back on before we say we agree or we don't agree with that portion. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Those are my submissions and inputs.
Thank you, Ubaba Umfene. Mundis?
Bangat.
Gena Mbwethu.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Greetings to all members of the Portfolio Committee, to the Minister, and to the Department. Honorable Chairperson, actually, I'm agree with the notion that the NLTA should return to us so that we can debate and make our submission to that NLTA. But my concern, Chairperson, I don't know if you hear me because of the network issue here. My concern, Chairperson, is that one. If you check the whole presentation, it talk about the interventions of the provinces and the national department to municipalities. But there is nothing that talk to the capacitation of the municipalities. Because if you want, because the constructions and implementation are being happened at the municipalities. But if you don't capacitate the municipalities or the metros for implementation, it means that we are now centralizing the whole process of this bill. So, Chairperson, I cannot talk more because if the committee do agree that we are going to return that one to the portfolio committee and have a time frame, as our Honorable Mangu says, I think I can stop there. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Mondise, siyabonga mfowethu yezwa.
Mangathi.
Siyabonga. Nangwane eduze kwakho na akasazazi isiZulu ngwane. Ngwane. Honorable Makhosini.
Thank you, Chair.
So I got one.
Mina, I've got a different view.
Okay.
Why don't we follow the normal procedure of doing our job? And after doing our job, hand over to NCOP so that it can do the completion and hand over. Then my question would be, if the municipality is unable to do or perform a certain function, what is to be done? Is the function to be neglected, or is the province allowed to intervene and lay a helping hand as a sphere of government? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Makwazini.
I'm done, Chairperson. I said thank you. Did you hear me?
I have not suggested that you are not done. I want to just get clarity from you. As I'm listening to you, you are agreeing that we should undertake a process that will allow us to amend, delete the clause as raised by the president. But your different view is, when should we interact with NCOP? Do I hear you properly?
Exactly, sir.
Thank you very much. The rest of the clarification issues, we will allow the department to come back and clarify. Thank you. That is the last hand on my list. Let's get clarifications. There were questions for clarity. Valerie, you want to clarify the process before I give back to the department?
Chair, there was a question on who initiates, if the committee agrees to a joint meeting, who initiates it. It will be the portfolio committee, because the referral reads, of the reservations reads that it's the portfolio's committee's duty to consider those reservations and report on it. There was also a question on time frames, Chair. I would suggest, Chair, looking at the Parliament program, a good time to process this bill further would be directly after the budget votes and the strategic planning sessions. So it would be towards May of this year. And then, Chair, at what stage does the committee, if it meets with the NCOP, at what stage does it meet? If the committee agrees to the president's reservation, Chair, I would suggest to meet as soon as a decision has been made and when there is at least a draft list of amendments. I'm not sure if there's any other questions, Chair.
I think there will be a question here, which is a technical question. One honorable member says he feels that this bill was hastily processed. I think we need to heed that call and take and be proper this time around. If there's an issue of feeling that we are running too fast ahead of us, as the joint committee, we should look into that issue. I see a hand up. Honorable Nzinga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, this bill is tagged as a Section 76. I would strongly suggest, Chairperson, that you from your chair also lodge an inquiry in terms of parliamentary procedure and just find out whether there's been previous similar conditions, because I'm not convinced that a meeting with a select committee would cover the process of involving provinces adequately in the representation of the select committee. So what I recommend, Chairperson, is that you just find out legally and procedurally so that we don't run into trouble in the mere acceptance that an engagement with a select committee in the NCOP indeed represents all nine provinces. If you could just get that clarity for your own sake, Chairperson, just as a word of caution. Thank you, Chair.
Duncan Chen. Thank you, Honorable Member. Valerie, let's ensure that we follow all the legal requirements that we should check as we move. Honorable Manu.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for that. My colleague, Honorable Hunsinger, keeps on throwing things and doesn't make a suggestion. Assuming that his advice to you is correct, that it doesn't include everyone in the provinces, what would be his proposal? So that we don't go back and forth, so that when you get that advice, at least you take everything into consideration, so that when we move swiftly. So I would plead with my colleague, which we appreciate always, his input and advices. What could be an advice should that be the case as he's suspecting? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Manu. I'm sure once we have an opinion on this matter, we will follow that opinion. Honorable Hunsinger is raising this as a caution that as we move, let's make sure that we have closed all the loopholes so that we're not seated here for the third time because we have missed a step. So the opinion or the legal advice will dictate to us how do we move forward, and I will, should there be any other issue that is raised, and I will bring it back to the portfolio committee to deal with it so that it's a collective effort. Let me allow the department at this point in time to clarify issues that needs to be clarified. If there are any issues from the side of the department, Kibi or Ubabu Matia, acting DG. Anything from your side? Oh, Minister is still here. I thought you were gone, Jola. My apology. Ngena, Minister. Honorable Minister?
Honorable Chairperson, very briefly, in terms of the issues, Hunsinger, we have noted the concerns raised by Honorable Hunsinger, and we are happy to engage with the committee on the matters of concern once this process has been concluded. Honorable Manu, the reliance on Section 5(6) is to the extent that the minister is empowered to issue directions to provinces, to provincial executive councils or municipal councils. And such interventions will include a determination of the to enable the province or municipality to the NMTA to provide necessary to municipality in Honorable Sitole, In my opening remarks, I emphasized the point that our policy posture favors strengthening the capacity of provinces to step in and ensure there is no vacuum. But this extends to assisting municipalities in developing the requisite capacity. This is a similar point Honorable Makosini also raised. I don't know, the departmental people want to clarify some of the issues, salient points out of the interventions, but thank you very much, Manget, Chairperson.
Honorable Minister, thank you very much. Let's see if the officials of the department wants to add. I'm sure they can't deduct or subtract.
Honorable Chairperson, I think the Minister has covered most of the points made in his response. So I don't think I should be adding anything, except just to say that the NLTA does give us, as he said, there are provisions within the NLTA that then allows him to intervene, and that also then mandates us as national to build capacity for both spheres, provincial and municipal, and also allows the provincial sphere to build capacity. So there are provisions in the Act that allows us to do that. We must just make sure that we implement them. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much. That settles this item. We now can move to the next item. Next item will be the responses by the department on ERT bill. Just want to check. Responses by the Department of Transport on further written submission comments on the proposed additional amendments. Let's go back to the department. If the minister wants to start, we're fine with that. But back to the department.
We'll hand over to the ADG on this one, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the members and the minister and the colleagues from the department. Chair, the deliberations on the economic regulation of the Transport Bill 2020, and then the department will be represented by Ms. Mashava, the EDG responsible for ITP. I will hand over to her, Chair. Thank you very much.
Mashava.
Good morning.
I'm sorry. Dukile Mashava.
Good morning, Minister. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, members of the Portfolio Committee, and good morning, colleagues from DOT. May I please share my screen? Okay. Thank you once again, Chairperson. I'll go right into the presentation. So ours outlines the PCOD written submissions, our general observations and comments, and the response from DOT. The presentation was prepared as a request for a matrix pertaining to the written public comments, which were received on the additional amendments in the A list. These were published on the 17th of December 2021 with the due date of the 4th of February 2022. As we had mentioned in the previous meeting, certain comments were received from the Secretariat of PCOT on the 8th of Feb 2022. The comments were received from the following organizations. So it was from the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works, Uber, Traction Shelter, Dr. Douglas Blackmore, Gautrain, Transnet, the Ports Regulator of South Africa, the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, the Regulating Committee, which represents ATNS and EXA, African Rail Industrial Association, the South African Association of Ship Operators and Agents, the Airline Association of Southern Africa, International Air Transport Association and Board of Airline Representatives South Africa, and the Freight Logistics Association. Basically, we made our general observations and comments, and as it relates to Gautrain Management Agency, they did not make comments on the A-list. However, they also did not have further comments to submit to the Portfolio Committee regarding the bill. The Western Cape Province made comments on both the bill and the A-list, and their view is that they do not support the bill, and they propose that the commenting period be extended to allow for further public participation. The Regulating Committee as well did not comment on the A-list. However, they did make certain proposals on the bill itself. The ASA, IATA, and BASA, they also did not make further comments to the A-list. And the comments that we received were mainly to the benefit of the aviation industry. The Freight Logistics Associations, they also did not make concerns or comments, rather, to the A-list, but they did raise certain issues as it relates to the bill. Traction Shelter as well, they did not make comments to the A-list. They did make comments on the bill itself, and they raised concerns on Section 8 and Section 50 of the bill. To move to the next screen. PRASA, they made comments on both the bill and the A-list. However, we noticed that the concerns raised over the bill were on how the bill would assist the entity to achieve its mandate as outlined in the Legal Succession Act. The Southern African Association of Ship Operators and Agents, they had no comments on the A-list, and they are in support of the intentions of the bill. Transnet, they did make comments on both the bill and the A-list, and they raised concerns around the price control and amendments of the National Ports Act. The Ports Regulator made comments as well to both the bill and the A-list, and they proposed additional amendments to the definitions and the clauses, and they require further clarity on the transitional arrangements. Uber made no comments to the A-list, and they have no concerns. They did not raise any concerns relating to the bill. And Dr. Douglas, also the comments were primarily focused on the extension of the definitions and certain clauses of the bill. And AREA also had their comments were primarily focused on the expansion of the definitions and certain clauses of the bill. Chairperson, I would like to invite the project manager, Mr. Mwaketsi, to take the committee through the matrix that has been compiled. Thank you.
Is he the one you are inviting?
Yes. Yes, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay. Arugunda.
Honorable Chairperson, good morning. May I request to be borrowed the sharing rights so that I can navigate around the presentation on the response of the Department of Transport?
You are borrowed the rights. Please navigate. Thank you.
Valerie? Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you.
Can you see the screen?
We see you, not the screen.
Host disabled participant screen sharing. The rights have not yet been given, Chair.
Oh, Valerie, please confer the rights.
Chair, I've given him the rights now, but can the department also send us the documents that they've been tabled, presented since this morning, because the table documents are different to what has been sent to the committee.
I did realize that I was trying to be polite. Department, please send us the new documents. Valerie did raise this matter with me. I thought the matter would be sorted quickly. Thank you, Valerie. The rights are conferred and that they make it, although temporarily so.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning once again, and good morning to the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Good morning, Minister. Good morning, colleagues. And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am humbled by the opportunity given to me to present the response of the department with regard to the comments received to date. As it was presented by the DDG, most of the comments were squarely on the bill itself, not so much on the A list. The institution that made a number of comments on the A list, it's the Western Cape government, which somehow helped a lot in terms of having to improve the wording and the drafting of the A list, which I will share with the members on it. But firstly, in terms of the table that is in front of you, I would want to begin to articulate some proposals which were made by ASA, IATA, BASA, which are the three associations in the aviation industry. In terms of definitions, the proposal with respect to the wording access is that it needs to be changed to be a user. It is important to understand that they are reflecting on their aviation industry, and therefore we appreciate their suggestion. However, when you look at the department's response, is that it is difficult to tailor-make definitions for each sector of transport or each subsector of transport. The way we've coached the definition of access, it's in the main to make sure that it covers all the transport subsectors, because the intention of the definition stipulated in the bill is to focus on infrastructure and facilities which are catalysts for access of movement of goods and people. And therefore, we suggest not to change the definition to reflect only the aviation sector, but maintain the current wording of access instead of changing it to user. The next point, which relates to the first point, is about access agreement. A similar response is provided to say we shouldn't change it, because if you change it to user, you therefore also have to change access agreement to user agreement. So we would want to maintain consistency in terms of access wording of the discussion around this matter. Then the additional comment that was made by Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works on access was that the definition should be extended to provide for other types of access seekers, not only those who provide goods or services to customers. And therefore, they propose that we revise the definition in light of this comment. Once again, the intention of the definition as stipulated in the bill focuses on infrastructure and access facilities, which are catalyst to access of movement of goods and people, which the Western Cape government appreciates that, but they would want us to extend the definition to other types of access seekers, which I would assume, because no further clarity was provided, we assumed that, for example, they would want to see accessibility to infrastructure be given to, for example, people who are selling foods in the train stations and so forth, which is really not the main focus of the bill. The main focus of the bill is operators using infrastructure that is owned in the main by government. And going to the next item, you would see the areas that I have been highlighted yellow. It's mainly to flag the definitional issues which have been raised for either clarification or for further definition, as I have presented now. Where the you would see areas highlighted blue, please note that it's comments that have been made specifically to the A list, which I have indicated earlier that the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works is the main institution that has provided inputs in terms of that. Their first input with regard to that, when you go to the A list, it's about the terminology that is infrastructure that we need to clarify it. The issue there, it's not so much about the actual definition. It's so much when you look at the A list, which is item number 6 on the A list. It says, please indulge. It says on page 7, after line 6, after transport, to insert an infrastructure. However, they would want us to change that and not say after line 61, but to say in line 61, which is correct, Chair. We would want to appreciate the comment that has been made and the suggestion. So we will adopt that proposal there. And the next comment on the A list by the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works, it's on clause 4. And their comment basically says the inclusion of regulators should follow a process of consultation with such regulators before they are included. And we agree with the point that regulators would have to be consulted at the time at which the minister will be ready to declare whether or not to include a specific regulator to the single transport economic regulator. However, it's important to state that the current existing regulators have always been part of a steering committee that was in place to develop the bill that we have. However, we would be setting up another forum that would look at issues of finalizing the business case and the implementation plan. And therefore, the opportunity will be used by this forum to also include all the regulators that we have currently. Furthermore, before the declaration is made by the minister to include the regulator as empowered by clause 4, the respective regulators will be consulted, which is basically the grounds of clause 411B provides for such grounds. In the main, the operational and financial personnel and technical capabilities of the transport economic regulator will be assessed for readiness and viability to house additional or more regulators. Here we're basically saying before the minister makes a declaration or determination, there would have to be a study of some sort to check the capabilities of the regulator to see if they can include these additional regulators. Another comment by the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works, it's on clause 4. It's basically requesting that it is unclear what other types of regulators are envisaged in clause 4. However, the issue is more of the weight regulator should be inserted after weights any other. If you look at the A list, it has Roman figure 1. Under clause 4, 11.1a, it has Roman figure 1 to Roman figure 5. So under Roman figure 5, they would want us to add the word regulators immediately after any other, which is quite acceptable, and it's something that we will have to do, which we appreciate as well as an input to shape and form this bill. Then the next comment really is about the inconsistency that have been identified by the Western Cape government, where if you look at clause 411B, the drafting of the report is triggered once the minister has determined that the regulators must form part of the regulator. However, clause 411CI states that the report must be published before the minister may consider making determination. So the issue here is about which one comes first. So we agree with the comment to say that 411C should come first, which would become the new B, 411B, and then 411B would become the new 411C in the A list that is provided in front of us. So it's merely about which one comes first, which is what we have to change there, Chair. Thank you. The other comment basically was that the amendment seems to be incorrect. That's with respect to the correspondence. The correct reference seems to be subsection 3 and not subsection 5. Thus, the clause should remain the same. We don't agree there, Chair, because we think when you look at the A list, how it has captured subsection 3 and 5, you would see that we have captured it correctly, because if you look at two clauses that have been added in page 26 after line 25, the cross reference starts with line 5, and therefore the numbering is correct. So therefore we don't align ourselves with the comment that has been made. We think the correct referencing is done here, Chairperson. Then in terms of clause 47, which is about amendments set out in paragraph 8, 4712B3, the amendment seems to be incorrect. It is unclear how a number of council can contravene subsection 13. Delete the proposed amendment. Section 4712B of the bill provides clear response to this matter, Chair. We think we don't have to delete the proposed amendment as set out in the A list itself. When you look at clause 54, which is amendment set out in paragraph 1, which is 54.1A, the word must should be retained. It is common to have a provision that says the minister may make regulations on any matter which may or must be prescribed under the Act. So delete the proposed amendment. We would want to maintain the may instead of have must, Chairperson and members, because it is not in every case or situation where the minister would have to make regulations on specific determinations. Hence the wording may would be relevant as advised by people with jurisprudence capabilities. So we would want to maintain the may instead of must. I think the last comment from the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works with respect to the A list is on Schedule 1, consequential amendments set out in paragraph 23, amendment of Section 13.2B of the Airports Act 1993. It's a small issue, Chair. It's the wording says lines, but basically it should say line. The wording says lines in paragraph 23 of description of the amendment should be changed to line. It's basically the removal of the S, which we agree with the proposed amendment. As indicated by the presentation of the DDG, most of the comments of PRASA are basically around the key mandate of PRASA, which comes from the Successions Act. And we think it is therefore not the role of the regulator to basically assist PRASA to achieve that mandate, because it's outside the scope of the regulator. And also it would be a conflict of interest if the regulator interferes in the operations and the strategic capabilities of PRASA. So PRASA would have to ensure that it manages itself. The second point they raise is that the bill does not address the issue of investment required to level the playing fields. This is aligned with the policy consideration, which recognizes that the rail sector has suffered from severe underinvestment in infrastructure and efficient operations, coupled with underutilization of the network and so forth. We think that this matter has been addressed under the purpose of the Act on page 8, which does make an emphasis and promotes investment in infrastructure in every sector of transport. It does not discriminate against other subsectors of transport. So this matter has really been addressed by that clause in the bill itself. Then the next observation, which is a comment by PRASA, is the fact that section 4, chapter 2 of the bill, which proposes that the application of the bill should be determined by the minister. But there's support to that section 4, which we note the comment. The other comment that has been made is that it is likely to be made applicable to PRASA, which is true. PRASA would be regulated once the bill is promulgated to become a legislation that has to be complied with. And their view is that PRASA will indeed become is currently a single operator in most corridors and therefore has a 70% shareholding. Basically, they are agreeing with the conditions that we have set up in the bill to decide which areas are regulated. The next comment of PRASA, it's on the definition of economic regulation. They give the reflection of the definition in the bill as you see on the screen there, just to save time. However, what they suggest is that the term entity should be defined to circumscribe the regulated entities. I think the issue, the definition needs to be reworded as follows. Economic regulation means in respect of this act, the regulation of and then delete markets, entities, facilities or services within the transport sector by determining A, the price control, which we maintain what we have currently, and B, access to facilities or services. We do not support that we delete the word markets and then include the word entity. We do not support that, but we accept that the definition could be then amended as suggested, where it says means in respect of this act, then the regulation of markets. We don't delete markets, entities, facilities or services within the transport sector by determining so and so forth. So basically we maintain the word markets, but we then include a new words, which is in respect of this act. So that's really the issue there. The next point, it's on section 43, section 43, 13, page 25, line 46. The issue is that it appears as follows. The president may assign to the regulator any duty on the Republic of to exchange information with a similar foreign currency in terms of an international agreement relating to the purposes of the act. This is how the act, the clause is reflected in the bill. So the proposal here is that the reference to the president needs to be defined. We need to define the word president. We think inserting the definition of president as the president of we would welcome the proposal, and then we will insert a definition of president to mean the Republic of South Africa. So we would add those words so that it reflects exactly which president are we referring here. Then the next comment on definition was from Dr. Douglas Blackmore. Basically, it's again around interpretation in page 6, which we need to add items on the definition of economic regulation. So they want us to strengthen the definition of economic regulation. And the suggestion is that the definition needs to be extended by adding the following items, which is any other transport matters that may be important consequences for the transport economic development of South Africa and or for the achievement of the equity objective of South African national government. We are noting the proposal, but it is already addressed by clause 31A and clause 32B in the bill itself. So this matter is under the purpose of the act and therefore has been addressed. So no need to modify the definition for economic regulation. We will maintain what we have. So the suggestion here is that we need to add a definition for the Ports Regulator of South Africa. We really don't think the bill would have to carry a definition for the Ports Regulator, given the fact that when the regulator, which is the Transport Economic Regulator, becomes in place, therefore the Ports Regulator of South Africa will cease to exist. And therefore, there's no purpose of having such a definition in the bill going forward. Maybe if the Ports Regulator of South Africa was going to exist post this exercise, then definition would have been needed. And therefore, we would want not to include a definition for the Ports Regulator of South Africa. And the additional point is the fact that we need to add the word authority to replace the regulator. And therefore, item 1, 6C, 7B and 7B of the Schedule 1 in page 37 deals with this matter, and therefore there's no need for us to include the word authority there, Chair. The next point is from the Freight Logistics Association, which is in brief FLA. Their comment is on the purpose of the Act, Section 31D on page 8. Therefore, their comment is that the terms of the bill introduce another level of restriction on private sector commercial transport operations by empowering civil service to apply restrictive regulations where there is no proven need for them. But we think the bill aims to deal with abuse of the market power and monopoly, which we all know. It is not intended to stifle the economy nor increase the level of compliance to legislation unnecessarily. So no suggestion is made by the writer here, but we think we noted the comment that the bill should not be an added compliance instrument to private operators, but it should deal with issues of market power and monopoly, which is really what the bill aims to achieve there. Again, FLA, which is Freight Logistics, the comment on section 3, 2A and B, the title of the bill is economic regulation, but it includes further social engineering, which is the first comment which is made. This is patent interference and manipulation of competition where there are absolutely no current obstacles to the market. It is difficult to understand the view of the writer here. However, what we have confirmed with this comment is the fact that transformation and advancement of workplace black economic empowerment are key pillars of our country and therefore unavoidable. But the view of competition in the transport sector is indeed one of the principles of the bill to carry forward, which is why we want to deal with entities which have attributes of monopoly and monopolistic behavior, in which is therefore a market where there's a market failure. Basically, we would want government to come in and deal with all the market failures so that you avoid uncompetitive industries, which obviously have unintended consequences in terms of savings, in terms of prices, and so forth. The next comment of Freight Logistics Association is on section 8. So that's section 4 on page 8. The issue is that the bill fails to define which sectors are to be regulated, why they should be regulated, and how the regulators of each mode will function. As it stands, it can apply economic regulation to anything from donkey carts and taxis to bulk railway operations, which indeed this is not correct, because section 4, it is very clear that the bill on its promulgation will continue to regulate entities which are regulated, and the minister will then declare which entities should be regulated going forward. It is not correct that it's a blanket approach, and therefore we would not align ourselves with the comment that has been made here. The second comment that was made by Freight Logistics Association is that the bill gives sweeping powers and authority to the Transport Ministry, which has a deplorable 30-year history of creating impractical and ineffective commercial transport regulations. It fails to provide adequate description of any identified need for such actions. Therefore, our suggestion from our side, on the basis of Section 4.2, we don't see a need for changes to this section, because the intention is clear that the powers that are given to the minister, it's only to declare whether a market is a monopoly and therefore has to be regulated somewhat, and also the role of the minister is to ensure that at the time at which it is right and the regulator has sufficient capacity and capabilities to include more regulators in that institution. That's really the powers that are given to the minister with regard to Section 4, which is the scope of the bill. We normally do get such comments on this section, so I think it should be noted by the Portfolio Committee that Section 4, it's one of the critical clauses which gets to receive a lot of comments, and therefore we need to at any given point in time be able to clarify whenever there are issues raised here. The next comment, which was from the Ports Regulator of South Africa, and on the A list, which is clause 2.5, the suggestion is that we need to insert the weight processing. Basically, in section 2.5, section 2.5 should read the access, protection, processing, which is adding the weight there, and dissemination of information, including personal and confidential information. We accept and agree to the proposal, so we will suggest the portfolio committee to amend it as such. Clause 4, again, which is suggested on the A list, hence it is highlighted blue there, is that the port regulator notes the proposed amendments as they relate to incorporation of other regulators into the regulator. However, when the amendment is read together with Schedule 2 on the transitional arrangement, it is clear that the Ports Regulator of South Africa ceases to exist and becomes a regulator, which we currently agree with the assertion, Chairperson. However, their view is that there are no transitional arrangement that addresses the fundamental change in the nature of the regulator and the decision-making on price regulation. This is not correct, Chair. In terms of the fundamental changes to the nature of the regulator, the new law will be applicable, which is the bill, with respect to structure inclusive of the CEO and the executive officers, meaning that the structure of the ports regulator, as it has always been indicated, will be a nucleus to set up the new regulator, and therefore the structure of the ports regulator will then be aligned to what is proposed in the bill, so that whatever positions and posts are allocated to the existing staff of the regulator, of the ports regulator, will then be aligned to the new structure. But as I've indicated earlier on, there is a forum that is being set up to look at issues of the business case, the implementation plan, and all that stuff. Some of these matters will then be discussed at that level. Currently, the bill caters for continuation of the decision-making of tariffs, which you would know. We're talking about price controls today. We're saying what is currently working will then be transferred as is to the regulator. And then as time goes on, the stakeholders of the specific sector will then engage to develop and design the new mechanisms of tariff determination and so forth. Chairperson. The next comment from the ports regulator is really on the establishment of the transport economic regulator, which is there, on clause 29. So they confirm that the body established the Transport Economic Regulator as a constitutional body. I think that's the assertion that is made by the comment that the Transport Economic Regulator envisaged here, it's being established as a constitutional body and not as Schedule 3A. We would want to emphasize that Section 29, 2B, reads as follows. The regulator is an independent and subject only to the constitution and the law. So this comment does not give assertion that the Transport Economic Regulator will be established as a constitutional body. We also assert to the fact that the regulator will be established as the section, as Schedule 3A entity, not as a constitutional body. So I think the bill itself does not give powers for this regulator to be established as a constitutional body, but a Schedule 3A entity as per the Public Finance Management Act. Their comment continues to say Section 29 also makes provision for two levels of regulator decisions. Therefore, governance decisions made by the board and regulatory decisions made by the executive regulatory panel. Yes, it is correct that the roles and responsibilities of the board is only on governance, which is the accounting authority. Then that of the CEO is administering the regulator, which is the accounting office and so forth. And the role of the executive panel, which is the CEO and then the executive officers, will indeed to make decisions on economic regulation matters, particularly on tariff or price control matters. And the next comment is on Section 10, that is to make provision for cessation, transfer or assignment of access rights to be reported to the regulator. We think this matter has been addressed in Section 7.2 on page 10. The next comment of the regulator, which Chair, I think from the presentation of the DDG, now that I'm remembering this matter now, and this presentation, whenever we issue bills for comments, it will probably make sense that a template is produced in which stakeholders or affected parties would use to comment, so that it makes it easier for the writers of the bills to be able to acknowledge the comments and capture them quite correctly. Moving over, the next comment was made by SASOA, which is the South African Association of Ship Operators Agents, which is SASOA. It is not clear to us what Section 4, which I've highlighted earlier on, that this is the section that gets a lot of comments. They say Section 4.1 is meant to achieve. They are not clear about it. Is this meant to achieve automatic application to, or for example, the National Ports Authority? In that case, the legislation does not authorize the minister to regulate at all, but refers to the ports regulator, which is answerable to the minister, which we agree. Where we don't, I think there's different of understanding. Section 4.1 ensures that current regulated entities continue to be regulated at an inception of this bill when it is promulgated, which therefore includes the National Ports Authority, which will be regulated under this bill. And Section 4.2 applies when new markets or entities or facilities are of monopoly nature, then the minister will make an appropriate determination, as earlier alluded to that. In view of the above, there is nothing wrong to be concerned about here, which is the intention is very clear and very pragmatic to deal with the challenges that emanate and that led to that Section 4 to be introduced. The next comment from SASOA, it is also our view that the bill should apply to the South African Maritime Safety Authority. Our view that SAMSA, the South African Maritime Safety Authority, is a safety regulator and thus there's no need to regulate a regulator. A regulator cannot regulate another regulator. So that would be a problem with separation of responsibilities and roles there. The next comment of SASOA is that, as previously indicated, we wholly support the application of the bill to other divisions of Transnet which we intended to do. It has become abundantly apparent to us that as the regulator established under the National Ports Act, number 12 of 2005, restrains the charges of the National Ports Authority. Its other divisions that are not similarly restrained simply increase their charges in order to make up their shortfall. Here it's an issue of cross-subsidization that Transnet applies from one sector to the other or from one entity to the other. For example, from the National Ports Authority to Transnet Freight Rail. And we're noting the comment, which is this is exactly one of the problems that the bill aims to deal with. But we think the corporatization of National Ports Authority as well helps to alleviate the problems that emanates with having this institution under Transnet in totality. The next comment from Sasoa is that we do not support the ability of the minister in consultation with the regulator in terms of Section 4.2 or not to declare private entities to be subject to the Act. Really, their comment is basically to say the bill should be subject to public sector entities only, which we don't really agree. For example, there's arguments now that the Richards Bay Coal Terminal could be a terminal that is of monopoly, which is owned by private sector. And there are many reasons enough which are driving towards the fact that they should be considered for regulation, which is another step that will unfold immediately when the bill gets promulgated. Another comment from Prasa was on Section 5, page 9. Here it's that in Section 1, page 6, lines 53 to 54, the term facility is defined to include the word infrastructure, yet in Section 5 and other parts of the bill, the word infrastructure is utilized distinctly from the term facility. We think the definition for facilities provided, does the two words can be used interchangeably. I think the issue of Prasa here was that whenever we use the word infrastructure, we must include the word facility, which from our side, we don't see that as a major concern because those two words can be used interchangeably. And a definition for facility has been provided in the bill itself. The next comment is on section that relates to the type of access request and access fees. The section 61C, page 10, line 5 to 8, they captured it as is, which is the request to make investment in order to increase the capacity of infrastructure that has been determined in terms of Section 4, where the owner of the said infrastructure has declined to make the requested investment and so forth. It is unclear how this section is a regulated activity. Even if it is intended to be, it seems that the request can only apply where it is a matter of public policy, e.g. if the firm concerned abuse its market power and so forth. That's the comment is about saying that the issues of public policy should be made a requirement whenever the sector or market or facility are determined by the Minister for Inclusion in the bill itself. We agree with the view because recently we all know that the President has declared through the State of the Nation address that there will be third-party access to Transnet infrastructure, and therefore we assert ourselves to the view that the infrastructure owner indeed would have to give access to the operators. There's a suggestion of additional wording, so the suggestion is that we need to add request to make investment in order to increase the capacity of infrastructure that has been determined in terms of Section 4, where the owner of the said infrastructure has declined to make the requested investment to the requested specification. So these are the suggested conditions after this wording. So there is no need to include these conditions as they may be embedded in the regulations and or contractual agreement. So it is not the intention of the bill to cover every nuance that is covered by different sectors of the transport sector. And therefore, we don't recommend, we don't recommend that the portfolio committee should include these conditions in the bid, because different sectors may have different conditions which are not similar to those of the rail sector. The next comment, which is a different institution now, which is the African Rail Industrial Association, which is ARIA. Their comment is on section 7, which is about the contents of access agreements and notification to the regulator. A blatant disregard of terms of access conditions may not require dispute resolution, but an immediate dissolution of the agreement. So here the issue is that if there's disagreements or non-implementation of access agreement conditions, the contract should be terminated instead of entering into some sort of dispute resolution and usage of the council, which would be a dispute resolution mechanism that is put in place here. The comment and the proposal is noted, but it is not realistic because the infrastructure is very expensive and operators stroke access seekers are dependent on Transnet's infrastructure. And therefore, to have an elimination or dissolution of an agreement on the basis of non-compliance to access agreements conditions would be suicidal to the economy of the country, because it therefore means Transnet may not be able to provide that specific infrastructure to that customer and so forth. So we would want to maintain that the section 8 on page 10 of the bill is thus appropriate in this instance, and therefore would deal with issues of dispute resolution there. The next comment is basically on section 8.1, and it's about request for and consideration of access approval by the regulator. So the issue is that we do not feel the balance of power has shifted sufficiently with this bill. The infrastructure owner, which is TFR, can still frustrate access to the network via Section 8. TFR should become a train operator like other operators, and in an appropriate period of time, a new entity created to control the maintenance of the network. I think here an argument is pushed forward on separating TFR from being an operator and infrastructure owner. And the suggestion basically is to set up a rail infrastructure agency, which therefore leave the roles and responsibilities of TFR as an operator and compete like any other operator, which I think from our side, this is a matter that cannot be resolved through this intervention of this bill. It's a rail policy matter, which we think the rail policy will make a pronouncement on it, as it was earlier discussed in the NetMap that has been developed by the Department of Transport. For traction, as it was indicated, there were two comments made by traction. One of them was in Section 8, which was also about the request for and consideration of access to approval by the regulator. So the comment goes as follows. We do not feel the balance of power has shifted, which is more or less similar to the previous one. Sorry, let me see. No, it's a similar comment that has been made in the previous by ARIA. So seemingly when we assess the comments of ARIA and those of Tractions, they somehow similar, somehow they may have probably sit in a restaurant and compile these comments together. So, but their response is the same because it's on section 8. The next comment is on by ARIA, which is on section 10 on page 11. The comment says the entity must first notify the infrastructure owner and the regulator of its intention to cede or transfer the rights. So this is what they would want us to add. It should also be added that the third parties shall not cede or transfer or cede rights to any operator. We agree with the comment. The new section 10 should be as follows for the portfolio committee to consider. An entity that has been granted access approval in terms of section 9.1 or 9.2 may cede or transfer any or all of its access rights to the third party on condition that A, the entity must first notify the infrastructure owner and the regulator, and B, ensure all its obligations remain fulfilled, and C, third party shall not cede or transfer or cede rights to any other operator. So the accessor to, or the infrastructure access seeker may cede rights once. So the comment says you must not allow the access seeker to cede rights to a multiple parties going forward. So the rights should be ceded only once, which is what is being insinuated here. And the next comment of ARIA is about section 36.3 and section 36.5. The section 3 basically says the chief executive officer holds office of a term of 4 years, which is the current proposal of the bill. And then each executive officer holds office of a term of 5 years, subject to subsection 6. The question which is being raised here, why not 4 years, like the chief executive officer? It's a question, they're questioning the 5 years vis-a-vis the 4 years. We do not see a need to make any changes, as this covers a staggering appointment to avoid risk of all executive officers leaving at the same time. So it is appropriate that we leave 4 years for the chief executive officer, then 5 years for the executive officers, so that the risk of losing all executive officers is avoided going forward. And PRASA, on section 10, page 11, line 20, an entity has been granted access approval in terms of section 9 or 9.1 or 2, may cede, which is a ceding issue there again. The concessionary should be about to meet the requirements of access. Therefore, we suggest that the following wording underlined below should be inserted. We think the new section 10 that has been allotted earlier in the previous slide is correct, and therefore we don't need basically these additional wordings to include in section 10, but the change or reshaped section 10 is suggested for consideration by the portfolio committee. Now the regulating committee, which is regulating ATNS and AXA, their comment is on section 11.3, where they're proposing the word proposal to be replaced by board approved business plan. We would want to keep this word proposal in all listed clauses, as this follows from a strongly related to the main clause, section 11.1 and section 11.2 on page 11. So we'd want to maintain the wording proposal. In addition, you do not want to only prescribe only the board approved business plan to the regulated entities. Here, the point that is made here is that we should ensure that only board approved business plans are submitted to the regulator whenever a tariff determination is made by the regulator. We wouldn't want to restrict the regulated entities to this level, but we think the emphasis of the types of information required is captured by section 14.1, 14.2, 14.3, and 14.4. So we think we are well covered there in terms of the information that will be required at the time at which a tariff determination would be made. And the next comment, it's basically seeking clarity on the fact that an existing subsidy changes materially, which is a clause which is embedded in section 11.7 on page 12. Here the argument is that which entities are we referring to that are subsidized, and therefore this clause suffices. The comment comes from the aviation sector, which we understand that AXA and ATNS are currently not subsidized and possibly don't know that PRASA is subsidized, and therefore the clause covers for subsidization of PRASA and any other entity that would be regulated under this bill, so that whenever there are material changes to subsidization, and that matter is factored into the bill, and therefore we don't need to change anything about that clause. Chapter 3, clause 11.9a, which says when determining a price control, the regulator may impose conditions that A, provide for an annual adjustment to reflect changes in the relevant price index, which is the next topic which gets to receive the comments. And the argument here is that the clause appears to be incomplete. The regulating committee applies an CPIX approach, X being an efficiency factor, but the current clause seems to only allow for an efficient inflation adjustment. They suggest the following: provide an annual adjustment to reflect the changes in the relevant price index, as well as efficiency factor requirements. We think clause 9.11.9a, which when you read towards the end, it has these wordings, relevant price index. We don't want to stipulate upfront as to which model or which inflation tool should be applied by different subset of transport, hence the wording relevant price index. So we don't have to say upfront whether we apply the CPIX, which in the main is applied by Sunrail in their concession agreements. But the road sector is totally different to the aviation sector, and this will be different to the port sector. So there will be different tools or modules that can be applied to cater for escalations going forward. So no change is required to the, and clause 11.9b, comments made by ASA, IATA, PASA, and so forth, the regulator should be empowered to adjust prices if those standards are not met. We agree and welcome the suggestion, and therefore they propose that the wording be changed there to indicate that set services standards and a price debate, sorry, price rebate mechanism if they are not met, which we welcome the proposal and should be considered by the portfolio committee going forward. Chapter 3, ASA IATA PASA, the suggestion is to delete clauses 11.9c, 11.10, and 11.11. We do not agree with the proposal. These clauses are quite fundamental or quite important elements of the price control and price determination, and therefore we don't propose the portfolio committee to consider deleting these clauses, because they give expression as to how price control and price determination gets undertaken. And then the next comment is from the regulating committee on section 1110, which is on page 12. Basically, the suggestion is that include subsection D, which the suggestion is that entities to submit both approved business case and financial analysis to substantiate affordability by the users. Like I've indicated in the earlier comment, we don't want to restrict the information that should be submitted to the regulator when a price determination is applied. And we confirming that clauses level 10, A, B, C are relevant and are quite clear what kind of information is needed for a price deviation or a price control to be determined. And the next comment from the regulating committee on price regulation, again, it's section 1111. And the issue here, it's about the clause gives the regulator 60 business days to review the impact of the proposed price deviation and determine whether or not to approve it. So this is the function that is given to the regulator, and therefore 60 days is allowed for the regulator to consider the matter that would have been submitted by the regulated entities. In 15 days, the regulator would have acknowledged receipt of the price deviation request, and thereafter the regulator will have 60 business days to look at the matter. The proposal from the regulating committee is that we need to increase the 60 business days to 90 business days so that we cater for constructive engagements and consultation. We think we don't have to change the number of business days for the regulator to consider the price deviation request. because on its determination or after making a decision on the price deviation, then the regulator will then enter into discussions and consult the relevant parties. And therefore, we don't want to change and give much more latitude and number of business days to the regulator to basically consider a matter that relates to price deviation, Chairperson. The next comment of the regulating committee is on section 11, 13, which is at the top of page 13. Basically, the idea is that we need to incorporate these wordings, transparent consultation process that value users' inputs, works towards consensus, and results in informed decision-making. Chairperson and honorable members, the consultation process is provided for under clause 11.4 on page 11. Therefore, we don't want to suggest that these words should be added, Chairperson, under clause 11.13. The next comment comes from Asa Ayata on chapter 3, clause 12.2, which is about the regulators may conduct an extraordinary review in terms of subsection 1. There needs to be a possibility for an airline association to request for an extraordinary review. Suggest the following amendments to be made on clause 12.2.3, Roman figure 3, another person or association of persons. No need for this inclusion or association of persons because clause 12.2b or 12.2 Roman figure 3 is addressing everyone, and therefore we don't have to include the wording association. It says another person, so and therefore the association is captured by that wording, Chairperson. The next comment by the regulating committee on section 14 on page 13, basically it's the regulating accounting and disclosure requirements add the entire section 12 of the Airports Company Act number 14 of 1998 as amended. The proposal, I think their view is that thinking that the bill is only about aviation, which we caution the sector that the bill is about the entire transport sector, and therefore we don't have to superimpose what's in the different primary legislation to the bill itself, because we trying to cover each and every subsector of transport, the chair. Regulating committee comment on Schedule 1 consequential amendments. Subsection F should be deleted only. The entire Section 12 must be reinstated because it deals with economic regulation. It's the same point that was made in the previous comment, Chair. This section is for consequential amendments. We agree so that we do not superimpose information from primary legislation of respective subsectors of transport to the bill, because the bill, it's about the whole transport sector in totality. The next comment of IATA, BASA and ASA, it's on clause 15.1, where it says any person may file a complaint with the regulator. Their proposal, like it has been alluded to in the previous comment, that we need to add all association of persons. We don't think we need to add these words, because any person applies to even associations that they may want to file a complaint with the regulator and all that stuff, Chairperson. So it is covered by clause 15.1. Prasa's comment on section 16, the suggestion is that section 16 should be deleted, and consequentially section 48.1a at page 27, line 21. The proposal is not supported. We're not supporting the proposal because clauses are straightforward. There is hearing of direct referrals as appeals does not weaken the structure of the dispute resolution, Chair. The next comment, specifically from Freight Logistics Association on section 21, which is on the clause that says the regulator may direct a reduction in the current applicable price control for any facilities or services provided by the regulated entity. The bill totally ignores the fact that the freight transport sector is the key element of industrial supply chains, and that all and any decisions affected the sector have immediate economic impacts of the logistics of the industries concerned. Regulation is by definition a form of restriction. We think a directed price control reduction is a form of a penalty which can be levied on a firm which has contravened the bill. So the price reduction, it's a way of ensuring that the bill's clauses are implemented by entities that will be regulated. It will only be levied after due process has been observed for a finite period. In principle, it is equivalent to a fine, but with the advantage that the money is distributed to customers and thus restitution is made during the price reduction period, Chairperson. So it will apply to the regulated entities that contravene to the Act, so not to any other person. So this is like a carrot on stick approach that is being brought about by this bill. So where the entities are doing quite well, there's an incentive. Where they are not doing quite well, then there's a stick to punish and ensure that the clauses of the bill are being met, Chairperson. The next comment is on Freight Logistic Association. It's on Chapter 3, Section 11. And
recording in progress.
The bill comes in place. So the bill emphasizes that regulation will apply across the board, whether it's a government entity or a private sector or privately owned entities. So, Chair, so we're not focusing only on entities which are owned by government. And Freight Logistic Association, in rewriting the bill, so the argument on this point is a general observation to say the bill needs to be rewritten, and the bill needs to be rewritten modally. So meaning that there should be a regulation for the port sector, regulation for the rail sector, and regulation for the other sectors like your aviation and roads, Chairperson. We note the comment because it was initially when we started the project, we looked at that this model of having a chapter for each mode. It was then realized that the bill will be quite voluminous and the bill might be unimplementable. So, and therefore we must try and have a legislation that is not huge, but would be able to cover the whole transport sector, Chair. And therefore the points which are raised for different sectors, like in the port sector, that the ports regulator is the one that does regulation. It's the current status. It's not a new thing that they're proposing. I appreciate the fact that they are proposing that there should be a railway economic regulator. We think Chapter 2 of the bill basically addresses this vacuum, and therefore the proposal for a rail infrastructure agency, as it was set earlier on, it's a matter that needs not to be entertained by this project. It's a scope that is outside this project, Chairperson. And then these sectoral comments, most of them, we are noting them, and most of them are reflecting on the current status. But I think the most important one that should be mentioned here is about pipeline transport, which is regulated by ANESA. And we're also noting the comment that there should be consideration by this bill. But we think ANESA is an appropriate institution to deal with this matter. And it's a policy matter that does not have to be resolved by this bill, Chairperson. Clause 22.2, by ASA, basically they would want us to add the word any person. It's about, as previously mentioned, there is a need for association to be able to appeal, which we agree. There is a need. If they want to appeal, they can appeal, and they are covered by the wording any person, and therefore we don't have to enrich that clause with adding the word association chairperson. So we think any person covers everyone there. Section 28, one, our comment is that 20 days is realistically too short a time to deal with an appeal regarding a charge. Decision by the regulator just modifying this to 3 months. I think here is just a misunderstanding on the interpretation. The 20 business days is for only publishing the decision and for the whole hearing appeal. This is for the decision at the end of the hearing. It's not the whole process should take 20 days. It's only the decision that needs to be published on 20 business days, Chairperson there. Clause 28.3 by ASA, IATA and VASA. It's basically to replace the term general reasonableness with appropriateness. The words general reasonableness are sufficient for the bill, and therefore we don't think we need to change it to appropriateness, Chairperson there. The next comment from PRASTA on section 34.5, page 21, lines 50 to 51. The suggestion is that clauses must be amended, where you change the board to be the minister on the regulation of the board, may establish other executive committees and all that stuff. We do not agree with the suggestion because the minister will be interfering with the work of the regulator, and you don't want that, given the fact that we are establishing an independent regulator chairperson. So therefore, we don't, sorry about that, we don't align ourselves with the proposal, the chairperson. Another comment from PRASA on section 35.1b, the suggestion is inclusive. We need to delete the word inclusive. It is important to isolate the exact additional functions of the CEO. I think here it's a question of deleting some functions that are allocated to the CEO. But in terms of this bill, we think this is appropriate and relevant, and we need to be clear which functions are those of the responsibility of the CEO, and also noting the fact that the executive officers are not part of the board and therefore would have been subjected to different roles and responsibilities, the chair said. So no need to change this item. Plus again, section 36, page 22, lines 22-26. Therefore, section 26 should be augmented with minimum qualifications and experience for the chief executive officer and executive officers. We think this matter has been addressed by section 36.1, which is very clear, and no need for modification, Chairperson. So the issues of qualifications and experience have been addressed by the bill itself. IATA, PASA, and ASA on clause 38, elements that were included in the airports company and not included in this law, in this regard, suggest the following additions to clause 38: promote a reasonable interest and needs of users, restrain the regulated companies from abusing their monopoly power. We note the comments. In general, the objective of economic regulation is indeed to protect the public interest, which includes users. Therefore, the bill aims to deal with abuse of power and monopoly. So adopt as proposed. Yes, we need to adopt as proposed. We support that view, Chairperson. However, we think there's no need to insert it part of clause 38 because it is covered by clause 39.1b, Chairperson. So this matter is indeed covered, so we don't have to include it here, Chairperson. Then the next comment is on section 38, again, page 23, line 1-5 of by PRASA. In line with the principle that the regulator should regulate within the prescripts of law, the factors that determine the feasibility of the underlying section, where possible, connotes an exercise of a discretion. We therefore suggest that the factors should be defined in the regulation and what factors that the regulator should take into account in arriving to a conclusion. So, Chairperson, we think we noted the comments, but the proposed additions are not necessary as section 54 talks to the minister making regulations in a prescribed manner and form. And therefore, we think this matter is covered quite clearly there, Chairperson. The next point is on research and public information, clause 42.2. IATA, ASA, BASA, their comments suggested that clause, any request for research made to the regulator must be considered on merits of its reasonableness and benefits to the industry, after which funding arrangements will be made by the regulator and other interested parties. We will support the suggestion, Chairperson, and therefore suggestion is supported, and clause 42.1 is actually dealing with this matter, Chairperson. The next point is on price control by the same institutions or associations in the aviation industry. The proposal is that each regulated entity must submit a proposal to the regulator and to the user. I think this is borrowing from the earlier presentation where they were suggesting that we change the word access to user. But we think clause 11.4a does indicate that the regulated entities must submit a proposal to the regulator and interested parties. We don't have to be specific in terms of the user or so forth. And therefore, no need to insert these words in this sentence, Chairperson. The next area of comment, section 47. By PRASA, it's on the council fulfills a critical function that requires totally skilled and experienced person to be appointed, which we agree. It is desirable that the appointment is transparent and hence the minimum qualifications and experience should be indicated. This matter, Chairperson, is similar to the one raised earlier on about the CEO's experience and qualification required. It is addressed under section 47.3. Which is very clear, and therefore no need for modification there, Chair. Section 15, which deals with funding for the regulators and the council, we are concerned that the cost of running the two new entities could run away and create an inefficient bureaucracy funded by the operators. The regulator and the council should be fully funded and controlled by Parliament. From where we sit, with which we have been presenting to the committees, that funding from the fiscus is unavoidable in the short term though, but in the medium to long term, the institution should be self-funding. The principles of how fees are charged to regulated entities will be set as follows. There will be concurrency of the Minister of Finance with the Minister of Transport to set these fees. The overall amount of money collected will be in line with the needs of the regulator and the council and the actual cost of regulation. So regulated entities will be benefiting from decisions that would be made by the regulator, and therefore they need to contribute to the running of these institutions. So checks and balances to ensure that the regulator is as efficient as possible in completing the regulatory task, and regulation is only undertaken chair. So independence financing is critical for regulatory independence, which we are well aware that at the time at which the regulator is self-funding, this principle of independence will be applicable at that given moment. Chair. Funding of the regulator and the council, again, but a comment now is made by PRASA, the suggestion in that section 50 be amended as shown in the screen there, with just saving time. The suggestions basically of adding these points are not supported. That is excluding weights as determined by the minister. We are allowing self-regulation to take place by the regulator. If we do so, we are allowing self-regulation, which is not what we intending to do here. At the most, regulated entities will not pay fees to fund the regulator and the council, which is contradictory to what I have mentioned earlier on. The next comment is on the establishment of the Transport Economic Council on section 46. The comment is that please insert the purpose of the council to provide context to its functions in section 48. We think section 46 and 48 explains the purpose and role of the council, so no need to add more wording there, Chairperson. Just one comment was made on the A list by area. Basically, it's around compiling a short list of at least nine candidates. So setting a minimum of the shortlist is restrictive, which is their comment. What if the nomination is for replacement of one member who has resigned or been removed? So within clause 47(3)(a) and D of the A list addresses this matter. This is also covered by the clause 47(3)(d) of the A list, Chairperson. So this matter as well is covered today. ARIA again, section 47A, their comment is that it is not clear how 3-year term or 4-year term members determined. Section 47(8) is very clear in terms of first appointments and or any time there is a complete simultaneous turnover in the membership of the council, thus the terms of the council members must be varied. It's a similar a point that was raised on the regulator about the 4-year term of the CEO vis-a-vis the 5-year terms of the executive officers. Here, a staggering approach is also adopted here for the council itself, the chairperson. So whenever the portfolio committee is making appointments of council members, they would then have to factor this matter to avoid the risk of turnover that might happen at the very same time. The next comment of ARIA on section 49(2) basically is that under clause section 49(2), without limiting the generality of subsection 1, an employee, stroke investigator, or inspector retained by the regulator before participating in any investigation. Significant relationship must be defined under definitions. In general terms, it refers to a spectrum of close emotional connection. The definition of significant relationship is addressed by section 49(3). So we do have a definition there in section 49(3). It is not under the definition list because it's captured by this clause here, Chairperson. ARIA again, section 50, we are concerned that the cost of running the two entities could run away. It's a similar comment and a similar response to this matter that was raised earlier on. Hence, I was saying the comment somehow indicates there may have been collusion or discussion by ARIA and Traction before submitting the comments to the portfolio committee. The next comment is on section 58(3), page 32, line 5. The inspector must always be accompanied by a police officer. We suggest section 58(3) be amended as follows. Basically, an inspector authorized to conduct an entry and search in terms of section 53 must be accompanied and assisted by a police officer. We totally don't agree. We don't think there are changes needed to say must, given the fact that a matter will be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Where there's a need for police officers to accompany the inspectors, the regulator will apply for such. Where there's no need for police officers to accompany the inspectors, indeed, they would not apply this law. So they must basically indicates at every given moment an inspector must be accompanied by police officers, which we think it will increase the capacity constraints of the police officers that we currently have. So we don't want to do that with this bill, Chairperson. That's really the point there that is being addressed today. Then on offences relating to the regulator and the council, section 64, a person commits an offence who does anything calculated to improperly influence the regulator concerning any matter connected with an investigation, delete the word calculated. It may be problematic since a person may still do something uncalculated to improperly influence the regulator. This is a transgression to the act out of intention of calculatedness is immaterial. So the department is amenable to the suggestion, Chairperson. We think the committee should consider deleting the word calculated. Another comment of ARIA on the A list, basically, it's about line 10 on page 39 of the bill. The point is not important. The comment is not clear, Chair. It was just flagged as such, and therefore we're not quite sure what was intended by the commenter there or the writer of ARIA's comments, Chairperson. Western Cape Government, Schedule 1 Consequential Amendment. A lot of comments, some of the comments of the Western Cape Department are basically on NLTA, which are helping to enrich Schedule 1, which is the consequential amendments. It is recommended that Section 28 of the NLTA be amended by insertion of the words and any price controls determined by the regulator after the words subject to the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act 2007 and blah, blah, blah. Support that Section 28 of the NLTA be amended and stated under Schedule 1 under consequential amendment. Chairperson, we support that. Schedule 1, again, consequential amendment to Western Cape Government. Section 38 of the NLTA is also impacted upon by the bill, as it will also be subject to the determination of the regulator. Municipal freight transport policy and strategy should be mindful of the regulator's determination. The comment is noted and supported, Chairperson, there. And the next point that has been suggested there is that Section 41, 1C of the NLTA negotiated contract will also be impacted upon. Contracting authorities are empowered to enter into negotiated contracts, one of the purposes of which is facilitating the restructuring of a parastatal or municipality transport operator to discourage monopolies. We agree, Chairperson, and we note the comment, Chairperson, that on that one. And the next one, it's the bill will be impacted on Chapter 6 of the NLTA, which relates to regulation of road-based public transport. Yes, we agree with this comment, given the fact that the National Public Transport Regulator will at some point be consolidated into the regulator itself. And the next comment under Schedule 1 by Transnet is that Transnet basically is proposing that the 20 days be increased to 30 days, which I think the department is amenable to that, agrees with that point. But we have noted the comment by the Ports Regulator of South Africa that they are happy to leave it at 20 business days. But I think we need to strike a balance between the Ports Regulator's comment and the Transnet's comment. But I think 30 days from our side, we are comfortable to capture as suggested here, Chairperson, for your consideration. And points which are made under 1.2 and 1.3, it's basically Transnet indicating that they are happy with these clauses. And we note the comments of Section 1.2 and Section 1.2, Chairperson. Another comment, maybe I must indicate here, Chairperson, that Transnet comments were quite positive. And in the main, were under the consequential amendment, Chairperson. So, Schedule 1 on page 37, the proposal, they indicated that the proposal does not provide clarity as to whether the authority is still required to submit the tariff book to the regulator or not. Currently, the tariff book is submitted to the regulator for approval and sign off. Approval by stamping in a separate process. Transnet requires clarity as to whether price control includes the list of services and charges to customers, which will be approved by the regulator. The first comment, Chairperson, like we've indicated, that the transitional mechanism is that current economic regulatory capacities and functions would move over to the regulator as they are. And be operational as currently are now, Chairperson. Changes will only be made when discussions are made. But this matter is addressed in Schedule 2 under the transitional provision. Specifically, it is items 2, 1, 2, 2, and 2, 3 of Schedule 2, wherein migration will happen on current arrangement or practices. For example, item 2, 3B, on licensing, Chairperson. We also agree, we want to emphasize that the price control will then include a list of services and charges that will be determined at the time at which it is appropriate to do that. The next comment of Transnet, it's again on page 37, is that a proposal to amend clause section 72 of the National Ports Act by substituting subsection 4, which enables the authority to enter into agreement with licensed operators and port users based on variation of tariffs as contemplated. Clearly, on these matters, all these matters are stipulated in section 7 on page 10. This section talks about contents of access agreements and notification to the regulator. In principle, the regulator will get involved when there is a disagreement between access owner and access person. So I think this matter is addressed under that section. With that note, Chairperson, I think I end my presentation here. Thank you so much for your indulgence. Thank you so much. Chairperson?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, for allowing me to make this presentation and your indulgence. I hope I have given you much to think about.
It's good on Alistair Mina, man. No, thank you very much, Mr. Scudo. I think you were equal to the task. That is why they had requested you that you should deal with this matter. Thank you very much. Honorable members, this is the responses by the department, and we will find time as the portfolio committee to have our say in terms of whether we agree with the department or there are issues we want to really change. Therefore, I don't know if at this point there is anybody who wants to clarify anything. Otherwise, we should be ready to commence with the process when we deal with our own issues in the future. Let me take 2-3 hands for any clarity-seeking questions. Thank you, Ndate Scudo. Honorable Honsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I don't want to prolong our agenda. Suffice to just say I'm pleased with the reaction which we received. You will recall that this was in an additional public participation process, and it then proved to be of value. And therefore, Chairperson, I thank you for also allowing this, because it was exceptional, but it certainly proved to be worthwhile, and therefore it would rather be seen as a credible move by the Portfolio Committee and you as a chair. Thank you, Chair.
Your constituency has done very well, Honorable Hunsinger, I must say. Mr. Scudo kept on mentioning your constituency that side. So thank you very much also for having come to the party. Otherwise, the department, I wish to move away from this item. We will interact with the details as we do our work as a portfolio committee. Thank you. You have given us food for thought. Mr. Scudo, kudos. Kudos to you, Mr. Scudo. Thank you very much. I can see you want to laugh when we don't see you. Can we then move, honorable members, to the next item? That will be the item that deals with the briefing by the Department of Transport on the International Convention on the Civil Liability for Bankers Oil Pollution Damage. And this thing says 2001 in terms of Section 23, subsection, or Section 231, subsection 2 of the Constitution. Who's leading us? Baba Madia. I'm sure the only senior person who's still with us here today.
Thank you, Chair, and also thanks to the members. And I must also thank my colleague, Mr. Scudo, for facilitating this marathon discussion. Thank you very much, my colleague. Chair, we will then request the next item, which is its purpose is to request this portfolio committee on transport to process the International Convention on the Civil Liabilities for Bunker Oil Pollution of 2001 for approval by the House in terms of Section 281(2) of the Constitution. I will then request Mr. Nduli Mpemba to come and conduct his presentations to the committee. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Over to you, Mr. Nduli.
Mpemba, thank you, Acting DG.
Good.
Mpemba,
yes. Good day, Chairperson, and thank you, Acting, and thank you, Acting Director General, for the opportunity to make this presentation. We are grateful to the committee, and also I would like to thank the Minister in absentia and the Deputy Minister who have assisted us up to so far that the matter is now before your Portfolio Committee, Chair. May I just confirm that the screen shows the presentation on International Convention on the Civil Liability for Bunker Oil Pollution Damage 2001.
Mpemba, you are spoiled for obvious things. Yes, you are right.
Thank you so much. In this presentation, so these are the matters that we will be covering. First, we'll deal with the background, the reason why South Africa must accede to the convention, the purpose, and the provisions of the convention. The third slide, therefore, clarifies that in terms of the cabinet approval of the Comprehensive Maritime Transport Policy of 2017, that is particularly in terms of policy statement 33A of the CMTP, the department is committed to promote a coordinated approach to maritime governance, and also policy statement number 33B, which provides that cooperative working arrangement between departments with direct or indirect role in the development of the CMTP shall be promoted. Now, I would like to take the members to 2001, where the International Maritime Organization adopted a historic convention, which is the Civil Liability for Bunker Oil Pollution Damage, whose purpose was to ensure that adequate, prompt and effective compensation is available to persons who suffer damage caused by spills of oil when carried as fuel as ships bunkers. So the bunker oil is like the petrol you put into your car for a car to move. It's not petrol that you carry in a tanker to be delivered elsewhere. The convention therefore applies to damage caused on the territory, including the territorial sea and in exclusive economic zones of states parties. The convention met the criteria for entry into force on 18 November 2007 and came into force internationally on 18 November 2008. Now, South Africa then, until now, had not ratified the convention. So the reasons why we are coming to the Portfolio Committee is because this convention has very strict liability for pollution from oil tankers, as was established by the International Convention on Civil Liability for Oil Pollution Damage, the CLC 1992. Just to clarify that, this convention, the CLC 92, South Africa is a part of that convention, but it only covers oil carried by tankers. So the Bunkers Convention was promoted to close the gap. So the absence, so what was not covered by the CLC 92 was the bunkers oil. The status quo then makes it difficult and costly for affected parties, including our country, to file claims and again create uncertainties regarding their ability to compensate for clean up in case of major disasters. Affected parties, including South Africa, may not therefore receive the compensation and clean up costs that may be needed in the event of an incident. Our strategy for marine pollution in South Africa, just to remind the members that it is based on four pillars. The first pillar relates to prevention, that we take a zero tolerance approach to prevention, that there must be no spill. But secondly, civil liability, in that those that are found to have spilled, they would then be held liable. And thirdly, compensation and preparedness and response. With the ratification of this convention, if we get the blessing of Parliament, this would complete the remaining portion of civil liability. As stated, that at present we cover tankers and exclude the ship's bunkers. So by adopting the convention, we'll close that gap. Once ratified and deposited with the International Maritime Organization, ship owners operating in South African waters and their insurers will now be obliged and have a responsibility to carry insurance and a certainty in terms of the limitation of liability which they enjoy in terms of the convention. So therefore, the purpose of this presentation this morning is to request the Portfolio Committee to process the International Convention on Civil Liability for Bunker Oil Pollution 2001 for approval by the House in terms of Section 231, bracket 2 of the Constitution, Section 231 to provide that an international agreement binds the Republic only after it has been approved by a resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. So what is now going to follow is just to take a trip along the text of the convention and highlighting the salient features of the convention. The preamble articulates the point that has already been mentioned, but importantly, that as you recall, that South Africa is party to the United Nations Convention, the Law of the Sea of 1982, which provides that states shall take all measures necessary to prevent, reduce, and control pollution of the marine environment. South Africa is doing her part, but also if the convention recalls Article 235 of that convention, so the UN clause, which provides that with the objective of ensuring prompt and adequate compensation in respect of all damage caused by pollution of the marine environment, states shall cooperate in the further development of relevant rules of international law. So this relevant rule of international law is this convention that we are bringing to the members this morning. Further, in the preamble, it is noted that the success of the International Convention on Civil Liability for Oil Pollution Damage of 1992 and the International Convention on the Establishment of an International Fund for Compensation for Oil Pollution Damage of 1992 in ensuring that compensation is available to persons who suffer damage caused by pollution resulting from the escape of discharge of oil carried in bulk at sea by ships. South Africa is party to this instrument. Also note, it notes the adoption of the International Convention on Liability Compensation for Damage in connection with the carriage of hazardous and noxious substances by sea, 1996, which has not come into force as yet, which South Africa is party to. It also, so the next part then deals with the the recognition that the importance of establishing strict liability for all forms of oil pollution is linked to an appropriate limitation level of that liability. What this actually means is the strict liability means that in the event that oil is found on top of the our waters around a particular ship, that ship around which it is found will be held liable for damage. So they don't even have to prove that they are not, but we would hold them. So that's a strict liability that the convention brings. It also provides that considering that complementary measures are necessary to ensure the payment of adequate, prompt and effective compensation for damage caused by pollution resulting from escape of discharge of bunker oil from ships. I'll then move quickly to deal with the definition of what bunker oil is. So for purposes of the convention, it means any hydrocarbon mineral oil, including lubricating oil, used or intended to be used for the operation of propulsion of the ship and any residues of such oil. The preventive measures also means any reasonable measures taken by any person after an incident has occurred to prevent or minimize pollution damage. And the incident means any occurrence of series of occurrences having the same origin which causes the pollution damage and create grave and imminent threat of causing such damage. The reason why we have identified these critical definitions because they are key in determining the apportionment of the responsibility and the resulting compensation that will be claimed. And this is the definition of the pollution damage, which means a loss or damage caused outside the ship by contamination resulting from the escape of discharge of bunker oil from the ship, where such escape or discharge may occur, provided that compensation for impairment of the environment other than loss of profits from such impairment shall be limited to the cost of reasonable measures of reinstatement actually undertaken or to be undertaken, and the cost of preventive measures and further loss or damage caused by the preventive measures. So this is the meaning of pollution damage, and it also provides clarity in terms of the limitation that ship owners would enjoy in terms of the convention, and clarifies what would be claimable by the state. Article 2 provides for the scope, which has already been articulated, and if you consider the Maritime Zones Act, that would it does explain the meaning of all the areas of the sea that are under the control of the Republic. So this convention covers that scope quite extensively. Article 3 deals with the liability of ship owner and provides an exception in paragraph 3.4, which would explain that the ship owner at the time of an incident shall be liable for pollution damage caused by any bunker oil on board or originating from the ship, provided that if an incident consists of series of occurrences having the same origin, liability shall attach to the ship owner at the time of the first of such occurrences. Let's say, for instance, the first occurrence happened along the coast of Mozambique into South Africa. So all those occurrences and the spills would be covered. So you would have a situation where Mozambique would be able to claim equally as South Africa would have a right to claim. Article 3 provides also for cases where there is no liability. And these circumstances involve, firstly, the damage resulting from an act of war, if there is a military conflict, and B, the damage was wholly caused by an act or omission done with intent to cause damage by a third party. The damage was also wholly caused by the negligence or other wrongdoing of wrongful act of any government or other authorities responsible for the maintenance of flights or other navigational aids in the exercise. So where it is clearly that the cause was not by the ship itself, then there would be no attachment of liability. There are exclusions, and the exclusions pertain to that the convention would not apply in pollution damage as defined in the Civil Liability Convention under whether or not compensation is payable in respect of it under that convention. So this relates to, recall that the Civil Liability Convention covers the tankers, so that will not be part of this convention, and also exception as provided in paragraph 3, the provisions of this convention shall not apply to warships, and state party may decide to apply the convention to its warships, and so we have that prerogative in terms of applying it, but in terms of the convention, it does not cover that. With also respect to ships owned by state parties and used for commercial purposes, each state shall be subject to suit in the jurisdiction set forth in Article 9. So all these constitute a list of exceptions. Article 5 deals with the incidents involving two or more ships, and it provides that when an incident involving two or more ships and occurs and pollution damage results therefrom, the ship owners of all the two ships shall be covered unless exonerated under Article 3. Recall Article 3 in cases where they are not responsible. It's war or it's a mistake of the state party. There is limitation of liability, and the provision is that the registered owner of a ship having a gross tonnage greater than 1,000 tonnage registered in a state party shall be required to maintain insurance or other financial security as the guarantee or a bank or similar financial institution to cover the liability. And further, a certificate attesting that insurance or other financial security is enforced in accordance with the provisions of this convention shall be issued to each ship after the appropriate authority of a state has determined the requirements in terms of paragraph 1. And a state party shall not permit a ship under its flag to which this article applies to operate unless it has this certificate of a limitation of liability. The Article 7 provides for compulsory carriage of the certificate, because this is the mechanism for enforcement of the convention. So once we are parties to this, so SAMHSA would have the responsibility of enforcing this, and the mechanism of enforcing it is to check whether the ship that has called on our port or is traversing our waters has this certificate on board. Article 8 provides for time limits, and this is now in case where an incident has already happened, and what is the until what period would you be entitled to claim? And the 6 years is provided as the maximum in which a state can claim. And where the incident consists of a series of occurrences, the 6 years period shall run from the date of the first such occurrence. So the maximum is 6 years under which you can claim under the convention. Article 9 provides for jurisdiction, and it clarifies that where an incident has caused pollution damage in the territory, including the territorial sea or in area referred to in Article 2, A, Roman 2 of one or more state parties, or preventing measures have been taken to prevent or minimize pollution damage in such territory, including territorial sea or in such area, actions for compensation against the ship owner, insurer or other person providing security for the ship owner's liability may be brought only in the courts of any such state parties. So there's a reasonable notice provisions, and each state party shall ensure that its courts have jurisdiction to entertain actions for compensation under this convention. Article 10 provides for recognition and enforcement of judgments given by a court with jurisdiction in accordance with Article 9, which is enforceable in the state of origin, where it is no longer subject to ordinary forms of review, shall be recognized in any state part. And this is where the cooperation and the spirit of working together by parties to the convention is cemented. Articles 12 to 19 contain general provisions relating to signature, ratification, acceptance, approval, entry into force, amendments, depository transmission, and languages. So we will not go through those in detail. Before we came here, Chair, we went all over to ensure that we consulted those that will be impacted by the Republic's decision to accede to the convention, and those are listed there, and you can see that it is a comprehensive list of stakeholders that we consulted. With these chair members, Director General, our request, therefore, is that we request approval of the International Convention of Civil Liability for Panga Oil Pollution 2001 in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution. I thank you for your attention, Chairperson. Mangate.
Thank you very much for the presentation, sir. Thank you. You are straightforward. I funa rule len. Usfunela nje ukuthi si approve uhambe mphephetho. Umuntu lokunja ukuthi obani? Ambili uDumisani.
Umphemba, indlela kaSobisi.
Sengithi mphephetho. Nako ke mphemba. There is a process, honorable members, that we shall be following to assist the department. For now, we can take the presentation as being heard. I know there is a process that that should be followed by Valerie. And then thereafter, we can do what we are requested to do. This thing must first go through the ATC, and I will request Valerie to do that immediately. Honorable May.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd only like to ask only one question. We are talking about the dumping of oil. What about toxic cargo?
Toxic cargo.
Yeah, we have had the ship about, I think it's about 6 weeks ago in Durban. And I would like to know what was the deciding factors that determined dumping toxic cargo of NSS Qingdao. I think that's the name of a ship. I'm not 100% sure. Only 250 kilos from our coast and not further. I know we are discussing oil, but I mean toxic cargo is such a big problem.
Thank you, Honorable May. You always raise these issues, and they will answer you.
Yes, thank you.
Toxic cargo, Honorable Unsinga.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have three questions. If you will allow this, please, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. Firstly, thank you very much for the presentation. I would like to ask a question on your slide 5. There was a reference about the status quo, which make it difficult to file claims. Can you just expand on that particular bullet point? I think it was bullet point number 3. On your slide 5, that the status quo, in other words, the current conditions, make it difficult to file claims. Then just a question out of curiosity, how would one handle the situation where it is found that more than one vessel has been responsible for a particular situation of pollution? I also know that there's been debate on lowering the limits of a particular claim where liability would be triggered. What is the process in determining the volume of dumping or the volume of spillage? Because this bunker is rather relates to the own use rather than the storage of the use. But how is this thing determined? What is the current status with regards to coastal states neighboring us? In other words, Namibia, Mozambique, and Madagascar. Because you sit with a serious element of determination and also territorial waters. If you could just give us some clarity on that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Unzinger. Babundul, Mpemba, Stelus Penduleva.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the members who have asked the questions. I'll start with the question raised by Honourable Member Peter May with regards to the related question of the incident concerning the dumping of the toxic cargo. So what we saw happening in the down there in the Cape related to the preventive measure. So that is covered in the Marine Pollution Prevention Act, which gives the authority to the South African Maritime Safety Authority to act very swiftly in responding to an incident that poses as a risk to damage the environment. The report that we have received states and brings comfort to the department in terms of our legislation and policies that the action that was taken prevented what could have been a major disaster for us. The dumping itself was coordinated with the cooperation of the Department of Environmental Affairs, and the site that was chosen to dump is an established site determined by that department, which is the custodian of protection pollution prevention generally in the country. So although it is not directly related to this, but it is a matter, I must as well state that the Parliament also approved the ratification of the HNS protocol, which South Africa is now a party. That protocol has not come into force as yet, but it is about to come into force, which deals with the harmful and noxious substances carried by ships. So once it is in force, we'll even get a much greater protection, because even though we could have incident at present, HNS cargo incidents would not be covered. It's not only South Africa, but globally, because that instrument has not come into force as yet. The question raised by Honorable Hansinger relates to claims in cases where there is more than one ship or state, the recalling that for an incident to take place, there must be ships involved. So we would then treat the definition of states as meaning the ships of states parties, two more than one ship state parties involved in an incident. Article 5 covers that they will be jointly and severally responsible for the damage, and the post the apportionment of responsibility, there is an assessment, a technical assessment, which would determine the source and the extent of the damage, and this also linked to how then and how the limitation is determined. The convention stipulates that the limitation is with regard to, firstly, the extent of the spill itself, and the amount of work that will be required to deal with it, either to stop the further spill, to contain it, and also then post that process, there will be another assessment in terms of the damage to, for instance, marine living resources, fish. So you would have an assessment that would then state that this is amount of cost that would be involved in the rehabilitation of the marine environment, and it will also cover costs related to, let us assume that the spill reached the shore and it damaged the tourism potential of the Republic. All those costs are then part of the assessment that would then be undertaken by the state in cooperation with the International Maritime Organization. Now, there was a related question as well, which relates to, I think, the slide number 5, where we mentioned that at present there was a challenge of claiming. And the reason why there is a challenge at the moment is that even if we're to have a spill today involving bunker fuel, we would not have any leg to stand on in terms of claiming for that damage if it is proven that it was as a result of bunker oil escaping from the ship, because we are not parties to the conference. But we would only be able to claim for bunker carried by the tankers. So that's the urgency and the seriousness of the risk that we, that the Republic is exposed to. So I think, Chair, I've covered all the matters raised by the honourable members, and I submit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mpemba, for submitting. Valerie?
Chair, the adoption of the report on the convention is scheduled for next week. I will forward members the very short report, if not today, by tomorrow afternoon. If the committee agrees to it, it will be 80-seat and slotted in on the program for the National Assembly for consideration and approval.
Members, may I see an agreement to the process by raising of hands? Honorable Peter May? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The committee agrees. I can see hands from Honorable Peter May, Honorable Tamsanga Mabena, Keta Mabala Stola. That is sufficient. Thank you very much. Honorable Chris Unsinga, raising his hand also and saying, war. Okay, thank you very much. Can we lower our hands and move to the last item of the day? The last item of the day, according to my agenda here, is consideration and adoption of the minutes. Am I correct, Valerie?
That is correct, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we had 3 items on the 15th of February. The first item was briefing by the Minister of Transport on the festive season road accident fatalities. members saw the report and had views in terms of the report. Just to say, one member even said, now that we have stats from RTMC, there should be a program that runs for 365 days. Just to quote, the second item was deliberations on the economic regulation of transport bill. There was a presentation that suggested, indicated actually that there were 12 written submissions on this. And I guess that presentation is the one that necessitated this marathon presentation by the department today. And the last issue was the consideration and adoption of the minutes of the 25th of January. I've gone through the minutes. The minutes are correct. Can we move for adoption of the minutes of the 15th of February? Honorable McD.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection of the meeting. Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any seconder? The minutes must be seconded. So nobody wants to second the minutes. That's a problem today, man. Honorable Mangu seconds the adoption of the minutes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for rescuing us. We are so tired today. Valerie, our next meeting is on the 1st of March. Am I correct?
That is correct, Chair.
Agenda items?
Chair, from next week, the committee will start getting feedback from the legal advisors on the draft proposed amendments to the National Road Traffic Amendment Bill. That will be the main agenda item from next week, Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that Acting DG Madia. Are you still with us then?
Yes, Chair, I'm still here.
There is a bit of a challenge from your side. The two presentations that we had three presentations, in fact, by the time you were presenting the first presentation and I guess the second presentation, you presented what you did not send to us. It means the presentation was different from what we had. I did not want to really make a big issue, but it is a big issue. If this committee was another committee, the committee would have said, no, we did not receive this presentation. It would have caused a very big issue. I did raise this matter last week, saying presentations must come on time. It has changed a bit. Presentations were presented, but different presentations were then presented. So I want to request the department humbly to try and close that loophole. Valerie is very angry with me that I did not raise that matter. I thought I should raise it at the end and say, please correct that matter.
Well noted, Chair, and we apologize for that. We'll make sure that the updated presentations, especially the ones that were presented today, will be circulated through the secretary. Thank you, Chair.
Going forward, work through the presentation. Once you have a final presentation, send it to us so that we look a bit professional, me and you. That's absolutely the request. Thank you very much. Honorable members, let me take this opportunity and the department's official and everybody that is here to say this was a very fruitful meeting. hope we continue in this trajectory. From myself, the meeting officially adjourned. Long live.
See you next month. See you next month. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. We'll see you next month in a new month.
Those I'm going on holiday 29th and the 30th of February.
Enjoy
the holiday.
That's the end.